It's 88.5 KCSN. I'm Nick Harcourt, and Ryan Adams is sitting down with me to talk a little bit about the new album. It's called Prisoner. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
And thank you for inviting me to your space here in Hollywood. We're not going to say where it is, but it's a great space. PAX AM, what do you call it?
Yeah, PAX AM.
PAX AM. It's such a great studio, and it's nice to come down and actually see you in your environment. So I was aware of you from the Whiskey Town days, and then I think the first solo album, Heartbreaker, and in between then and now, a whole bunch of records as well, and a whole bunch of songs. Can we talk about songwriting a little bit and how that has perhaps changed for you and evolved through the years? When you first started writing, I believe you were writing stories as a kid before music came into the picture.
Mm.
Tell us about those early stories, and were they based in what was going on with you as a kid?
Well, when I was first writing short stories, I think that my main focus was probably to try to sort of fuse the writing of Faulkner and Kerouac and, the town and the city Kerouac. Like, I was interested in how he evolved, and I was aware of a lot of beat poets and counterculture writing at a pretty early age. I had some access to that stuff, which is really good. I think I was a pretty good short story writer, or I would, at least at 14, 15, and 16, that's all I wanted to do. So that's all I did. And so I just would write segues, and I would write the second chapter of like a book that I hadn't written. I would just sort of focus on things, or sometimes maybe I would maybe look at a book that I didn't like and think about the chapter or think about the first couple of pages of the book and wonder why I didn't like it. And then I would rewrite it as though I did. Side writing was something I did from early on. If anything, I think I probably have always written the same way, which is kind of out of necessity and based on a feeling of wanting to create something, and it's never really changed. The only time it was ever different was when I was in Whiskey Town, and that was because I was writing for what I thought was to fit a band, but which at first was more fun and just meant to be like what it was, and then it flipped into something that was more serious. So that was the only time where I felt like I had like a restriction on my writing style. And then, after that, I kind of quickly started to get my groove back and picked up where I left off.
What was it about those guys and their writing that made you want to write yourself?
Well, Henry Miller was a huge deal to me from an early age, and I loved Book of Friends, but I also loved the idea that, I loved the vulgarity of his writing, or what was seen as being vulgar, but what also was beautiful. I loved his ability to be very true. And I think I've always felt very much like, this sounds like I'm the kid from The Omen or something, but I've always felt very pagan as a soul. I've never really believed in, I've always felt like that there's so much reverential or there's so much that sort of held back and unnecessarily sacred in culture or is misappropriated, that I think just since I was a kid, what I couldn't find that led me in that direction led me closer to people who were interested in the sort of beauty and the brutality of the truth. And I think that that's what I got from people like Burroughs and Ginsberg and Miller, and then eventually Bukowski and,
How has your writing shifted to this new album?
I don't know that it has. I just think that there's the stuff that people see that we put for sale that becomes a record, and then there's what I really make. And if I really made what I wanted to, which I can't because of the way that the world works, it wouldn't be 16 albums. It would be, 28 records, because I make about two a year probably. but I release now about one every 2 years. But that's because that's the way that it works. That's the reality of who I am in the marketplace as a musician and what I can handle at my level with the fans that I have and then touring. It does require time in between. So the editing process becomes really more of a what can I do with what I have in that amount of time that still can make sense to me, that still feels like what it is. I mean, like when I wrote this last record, it was for me, it was 33 songs. That's how I always envisioned it, and I think I always will. What's the reality of what it is cool and beautiful and interesting, and I think Prisoner has an effect on it that is as powerful as it is, because I feel like it's part of a spell or a ritual that I had begun, and it's a facet of it, but it came from a much deeper source of material. But that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where you make records and their statements and people consume them on a level. And this isn't the Renaissance, you know. This isn't the time where people are sitting around and discussing philosophy openly and in a brotherly manner. It's a very strange time, I think, for art.
Well, and everything is just moving so quickly, attention span all around, I guess. Trying to fit into that as an artist is the challenge, and you mentioned having to edit yourself.
The reason that iPhones are so popular is because people are afraid of themselves. That's why people like social media, and that's why people like went from television as a distraction from the ugliness of who they think they are to iPhones. That's why you doctor a picture so to try to make yourself look better with a better camera angle. That's why you text a person something that you don't have the balls to say. That's why people blanketly like make these like pronounced, like ridiculous blanket statements, like on political statements, or they're like fictional versions of reality on these, like, it's the, like, social media is now like this new message board. Everyone's constantly, chronically hiding from the ugly truth, and the ugly truth is that the world that everybody created that really was supposed to be built on some kind of foundation of us being humans, exploring our humanity. At some point, something happened, and people became interested in, I think, distracting from that. I think that's why that's so popular. Anything that can take someone away from themselves. I get these questions in interviews all the time. They're like, so this record is really personal and like very dark or very heavy. And I'm like, are you familiar with the music of Ryan Adams? It's not, like, my last record wasn't called like Party Town USA. Like, you know what I mean? Although, well, I mean, copyright, you know?
You know, the thing is, clearly, yes, if you've listened to a Ryan Adams record or two, you got an idea perhaps of where you're coming from. But I would never want to put that on you, you know? I mean, that's just my interpretation. But,
right.
But from what you're telling me, I mean, you mentioned in the conversation just 5 minutes ago romance and heartbreak and all this stuff. It's a well that you clearly draw on.
Well, the true interpretation of the word romantic, the idea is that romantic is dealing with the nature of mankind, not man as a male. I mean, but,
well, it's not necessarily a boy girl thing.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, the dire situation, the darker or the more joyous, all of these, the sociological, the way that we fit in, all of those things fall under the term romantic. Doesn't have to necessarily mean that you're like, you know, like you're on the Titanic with your arms spread out on the front of it and you're saying like you're the king of the world. Romantic is also the fucking iceberg, you know. My music is the iceberg.
Yeah. So tell me about this collection of songs then. How quickly were they written?
Most of my songs are born out of necessity so that they kind of will hit the page with the – they just sort of hit the page at the speed that I could write them, and then they will exist there. It's a very interesting thing to describe because it's not there is no. I don't entertain fear or doubt when I write. It doesn't belong in my art. I don't accept that it belongs in art. I refuse anyone else I refuse anyone else's interpretation of my own art also, which doesn't mean that I somehow think that I'm better than other people. It just means that it doesn't matter what anybody will ever think about what I do. It exists on its own, and it's for me. So quite often songs happen because the tape is rolling and I'm writing a song, or I'm like jamming or playing acoustic guitar, and the words will just, they just happen. I mean, two of the songs on this record, the words happened as I was just playing them. Anything I Say to You Now is one of them, and Do You Still Love Me? I don't think I wrote a word of those down. They just happened.
But when you've completed that process of writing a whole bunch of songs and recording a whole bunch of songs that you know are going to be on a collection, an album, that this time is called Prisoner. You talked about having 33 songs.
This record was the first one where full bore arguments were happening outside of me about people who had favorite things, and there wasn't any real way to, for any, there wasn't going to be a right answer. There was just going to be an answer, which I thought was kind of interesting. And but that's, you know, I mean, that's kind of, you can't, I mean, unless you're in like DRI, you can't put 33 songs on a single album. You can't do it. And the record needed to be a single statement. So it took a minute. I mean, I kind of listened to AC/DC to get, I listened to them anyway, but I just listened to their complete discography as when I would run in the mornings, which I miss and I'll get to do again very soon because my long, crazy promo time will be over. But I just would listen to all of their records front to back, and then I would realize, like, okay, like, I see how they are doing it. And it prepared me to go, like, well, you can't make fly on the wall if you have, like, huge distractions in the narrative. And I didn't think about meaning that the record should be the same the whole way through. I just thought about the power of each song and what does it mean to have the consistency and the power of all that stuff link up. Like, I can't understand Prisoner because I made it. I can't understand what the songs are because I am from them. You know, does that make sense? Like, I came from those songs. Like, they kind of create me. I don't create them. Like, we're part of the same lexicon of information. And the stories of them, because I'll carry them along with me, they'll be part of me forever. But for someone to be able to listen to Prisoner on headphones in a subway and to hear those songs as themselves, the way when I listen to the Smiths or something, I don't always hear Morrissey. Sometimes those songs, I listen to them in my mind, and the experiences that he's singing about of the music are giving me, they're me. I'm like when you see a movie, you're not in Terminator, but in your mind, you're running as fast as you can. You are Sarah Connor, and you really do not want to deal with a T-800. although I do feel like we're all kind of in a lot of ways on Skynet all the time. But that's kind of the power of rock and roll for me, is that it doesn't mean anything if you're doing it to get a reward.
So when you say it becomes a part of you and you are a part of it, this is just a guy who is an artist continuing to evolve through the process of what you create. Is that a fair conclusion?
I mean, when I listen to like 4-track recordings that I've made when I was a plumber, like, I don't really hear anything that's different. I just think I have like I sound like a 64 Strat now, you know, which is awesome, you know. But I like, but you know, like, I did it on a Carvin. You know, I did it through a BV. I made it because it felt right, you know.
So the album's out. There's a box set as well, which I just saw. It looks very pretty, lots of colored vinyl. Tell us a little bit about the box set that is available for pre-order, I believe.
The box set is kind of a... It's this... thing that I wanted to do where I released all of the A-sides on 7-inch, and it opened up an opportunity for me to put some B-sides with the A-sides that were some things that maybe would have sort of elaborated or beautified the process of the thing that I'd made. The good thing about having recorded 60 to 80 songs for a record is that there's plenty of songs for B-sides. And then there's also side-written records and other passages of the record that still exist that haven't been touched. And these B-sides are, some of them, I had originally made them and I was like, oh, they're connected to this song in this way. I could feel them. And many of them came much later. But some of them really connected in a way that I thought really would have been very interesting. And the idea of making 12 singles for the 12 songs on the record with B-sides, I just thought that that was a very romantic thing to do. And I really liked the idea of somebody sitting down and enjoying records that way. The most insulting part of that is to then people see it on Twitter and like, when will this be available digitally? Which is usually this thing. And it's so funny. Like, I always just look at that and I always just think to myself when I see those questions, I just think, fuck you. Like they're my fans and I get it, but I go like, you're like, every one of those questions, I just say to myself, you're the reason I'm going to make something tangible even more. The loss of people having any idea of holding things that have been made and appreciating them, like, you know, giving them meaning so that they could give them to someone else. I just really love that. I don't think it's an old fashioned idea. If we were like surviving in the woods, you know, because all the power went out in the entire world, I wouldn't say to you, like, I'm going to go virtually find us some vegetables to eat right now. I'll be right back.
Well, I guess the point, though, is that you didn't make that box set for the people who want the songs digitally.
Oh, you'd be surprised. It's so funny. There's all this really beautiful stuff hidden in there. And I'm so excited about it. And in fact, it's actually such a complex and interesting thing hidden inside in different ways that even I don't know everything that's in there. That's the only way I can say it without giving it away.
So you've finishing up today. Tickets go on sale for The Greek. You've lived in Los Angeles a long time. You've played a lot of places around the globe. What's it like to play at The Greek?
I like The Greek. It's got a good sound. I think the bass, I like that the stage isn't too subby.
We should explain for the people who don't know what the subs actually do.
So if you're in your house and somebody like turn their car into like a boombox and they go by your house and they like knock off the picture of your cat that you spent like $20 framing, that's what I'm talking about. But it's the size of a stage. That's what sub is. So people will build these huge places or these like amphitheaters or these outdoor places, and they'll put the subs under the stage. So when you play in the bass player in the band, in this instance, Charlie, will go to play one note on his bass, it's like you're getting a foot massage that you didn't want or could never ask for. And that happens the whole show. So what's great about The Greek is that doesn't happen there. It feels like a rock and roll event.
No foot massages on stage at The Greek.
Also, it's nice because you're right there on the edge of the park, and park is so beautiful.
It's a great space.
Yeah, like, I mean, I know like a lot of hedge witches that go and collect stuff in that park, and it's like a really magical place.
So it's at The Greek on June 3rd. All right. Thanks for talking to me, mate.
Thank you.